This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. It's an incredible honor for me to have in the studio right here next to me, Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. A member of the National Women's Hall of Fame, Dolores Huerta, in 1998 received the Eleanor Roosevelt Award from President Clinton. And it's kind of like having Rosa Parks here in the studio, or John L. Lewis, or Walter Reuther. Dolores Huerta, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Tell me how you and Cesar Chavez started the United Farm Workers Union.
Well, both of us had been involved in organizing farm workers. I, in Stockton, California, formed a group called the Agricultural Workers Association, which then became the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee. But I left that group because they started working with the labor contractors. And the Filipino workers stayed there, Larry Itliong, who was the leader and whom I had recruited initially, because the Filipino crew leaders had a different system of working where they actually negotiated their wages and the food. They put up their own kitchens. They bought their own food, so they were able to get along financially better. But I left that group. And Cesar had organized a group in the southern part of California, which he turned over to the Packing House Workers Union. And that group kind of dissolved. So at that point, Cesar said, you know what, it's not going to happen unless we do it. And so that was the decision that we started the Farm Workers Union. We had both, at that time, had been working with a group called the Community Service Organization, which was the first mass-based civic rights organization for Spanish-speaking people in California and Arizona.
And a step before that, why did you decide to get involved in organizing in the first place? Why was that important to you?
Well, because of all of the abuses that were suffering, you know, that the Latino people were suffering in California, and, of course, especially the farm workers, because at that time we did not have food stamps. We did not have unemployment insurance for farm workers. Farm workers could not even get surplus commodities in the state. Unless you lived in one county for 12 months and you could have rent receipts that proved that you lived in that county, then you couldn't get any kind of surplus commodities. And so we were able to change that law so that as long as you lived in the state of California, because farm workers, when the crop finished, they had to migrate to another place to work. And so they were never in one county for 12 months. But once we got that law changed under the Community Service Organization, then as long as they were within the state of California for 12 months, then they could receive this extra surplus food that they gave to everybody.
And when Cesar Chavez said, you know, if we don't do it ourselves, this farm workers union isn't going to happen, what was your reaction? Did you think it was an impossible task?
Well, I didn't think it was impossible because I knew Cesar was a great organizer. I knew that I had some organizing skills that I had learned from Fred Ross Sr., who was the gentleman that got both Cesar and myself involved in organizing. The thing that really, I guess I'm always an optimist, but when Cesar said, immediately after that conversation, well, we'll never see a national union for farm workers in our lifetime. And I said, why, Cesar? He said, because the growers are too rich, they're too powerful, and they're too racist. And, of course, that's true. While the United Farm Workers has done incredible things, you know, in passing the laws in California to allow farm workers to organize and getting unemployment insurance for farm workers, disability insurance, just a lot of laws that we passed throughout the rest of the United States of America, farm workers still do not have unemployment insurance or workers' compensation, and definitely do not have a law that allows them to organize. So, but I won't see this, as Cesar said, in my lifetime. I'm 75 years old this year, but I know that because of other activities that farm workers are doing throughout the country, they have groups in New York State, called CITA. They have a group in Florida, the Immokalee Farm Workers, under the leadership of Lucas Benitez.
And they just won a victory against Taco Bell.
Yeah, they just got a settlement in terms of getting a better wage return for their work. You have Pacoon in Oregon. You have Flock in Ohio and in South Carolina. And so I think that there will be a national union of farm workers maybe in the lifetime of, not my children, definitely my grandchildren.
Well, I should hope so, and may it come sooner. Dolores Huerta, Cesar Chavez said the bosses were too powerful and also too racist. How did that racism manifest itself?
Well, it manifested itself in the initial exclusion of farm workers from the National Labor Relations Act back in 1935. When they passed that law, the law stated except agricultural workers. And when a past president of the Farm Bureau, a fellow named, I think his name is Jack Angel, was asked by a reporter, why did the Farm Bureau oppose the inclusion of farm workers in the National Labor Relations law? And his answer was because they were coloreds and Mexicans. That was his answer.
Can't get cruder than that now.
No, you can't. And, of course, truthful. He was at least truthful about it. But, you know, so there was a racist reason from the very get-go. And when we consider that farm workers feed the nation, they do the most sacred work of all by putting the food on our table. And yet they are the least appreciated and the worst treated members of our society. It shows the very, very great harm that racism, you know, how it impacts on people.
How did you get from just you and Cesar Chavez to getting contracts with growers?
Well, there was the organizing. Cesar Chavez and his wife, Helen Chavez, you know, who was a part of the group that we started. There were just the three of us initially. And then, of course, we were joined by his cousin, Manuel Chavez. And, we started organizing, just going through the state of California and meeting with workers, doing house meetings until we were able to form committees throughout the San Joaquin Valley. We called them all together to have a convention where we then set out the goals for the organization, which were to have a radio station, to get unemployment insurance, to get a law. And it was incredible that in that first convention, which we had on September the 30th of 1962, how many of our goals were met. I think almost every single goal that we set out at that first convention. Then later on, we, had a constitution, and we started out as an independent organization. We had a very careful planning and execution of our plans. But then, of course, in 1965, we had this major strike that was spearheaded by the Filipino farm workers of the Agriculture Workers Organizing Committee.
Now, a lot of people don't know about the role of Filipino workers.
Well, that kind of threw off our careful plans, but on the other hand, it really sparked a movement because when the Mexican farm workers, which was our group, the National Farm Workers Association, joined the Filipino workers in that strike, then of course, that was what caused the famous Delano grape strike, and then from there came the famous Delano grape boycott, which had been, the boycott had not been used as an instrument or as a tool by the labor movement since maybe the time of the 30s, and so the people didn't think it would work anymore. But when we did this consumer boycott and it worked, then, of course, the rest of organized labor then also started to do boycotts, which have been very successful over the years in helping workers get contracts.
And the consumer boycott, this was a national boycott.
Yes, it was.
And you took organizers from California and sent them all around the country, didn't
you? Actually, they were farm workers. They were farm workers that went across the country. And this is just, I think, the incredible thing when a lot of people, we kind of feel kind of hopeless and we feel that there's nothing that we can do to make changes, that the Delano grape strike had farm worker organizers, and there's people out of Delano, in Fresno, and just Coachella. They just went across the country and, spoke in churches and at labor meetings and passed thousands of leaflets on street corners and asking people to boycott grapes and then eventually lettuce and Gallo wine. And people responded. We had 14 million Americans that didn't eat grapes.
And then you got to bargain the first contract. What was that like?
Well, that was very exciting. I had done the legislative work for the community service organization, so I had some experience with language. And then I just consulted all the different labor leaders. Went to people like Lou Goldblatt from the Longshoremen's Union, who gave me some very good advice. The Longshoremen's Union had contracts with the sugar workers in Hawaii. And so, I just copied a lot of their language, and Lou Goldblatt gave me some very good advice on how to conduct negotiations. And so just, talking to people, looking at other union contracts, and then meeting with the farm workers themselves to see what they felt they needed. And the greatest thing about this is when we talk about contracts and when we when I speak and I tell people about these great, what we were able to accomplish for farm workers in collective bargaining, like, you know, having a medical plan for workers. Eventually we got a pension plan, rest periods, 15-minute rest periods every 4 hours. Then getting a lunch period. And then a job security, so people, when they were laid off, they could come back and their job would be waiting for them as the season ended. But, you know, eventually somebody will come up and say, the greatest thing that we got were the toilets. Because farm workers did not even have toilets in the field, cold drinking water with individual drinking cups, and, hand washing facilities.
Well, where's people supposed to do that?
Well, they had to go find a bush somewhere. I mean, basically, there were no toilets for farm workers. It was horrible. And it was interesting, too, that how the growers even objected to that. So we got toilets in our first contract in 1966. We didn't get a national law for farm workers until 1985, and the Farm Bureau opposed the law that said that the growers had to have toilets in the field. I mean, can
you
imagine?
That's amazing.
Well, then again, you know, that goes back to your whole question of racism. You know, people do not have a toilet, then that does mean that you're not quite human, right? And it's this whole idea of making people feel inferior by the kind of working conditions that they have to work in. And I guess the mentality is if you make people feel inferior, then they won't stand up and fight for their rights.
What is racism like right now as far as immigrant workers or others in the United States?
Well, I think it's heated up quite a bit. I mean, I think because of the war in Iraq, we know that I think racism has a lot to do with the war in Iraq, even because when we in the United States paint all Arabs with the same picture, when you have people who today still think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, which everybody that, you know, knows anything, knows that that's simply not true, that he had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, you know, and yet we had this war where we've killed so many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Americans, citizens that have been killed over there, and somehow we kind of connect that with 9/11. And I think if it were not for this inherent racism that we have in our society, that this wouldn't be the case. I mean, I sometimes think what it would have been, let's say that it would have been England that was responsible for 9/11, then we would not have gone and bombed Norway, right? You know, so I think that the fact that we have this racist mentality in our country makes it so easy to link up or paint, say, all Arabs and all Muslims, of course, are terrorists. And then this translates into this whole anti-immigrant kind of hostility that we have in the United States of America right now, and that extends also to people from Latin America or people that are people that have a brown complexion or black. Then right away, it increases that type of racism.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. The show is Progressive Radio. What do you think the policy should be about immigration, U.S. policy about immigration? I mean, Bush is talking about another guest worker program, for instance. What would an ideal policy be?
Well, it's really complicated. It's not very easy. First, for beginners, I mean, just to begin with, I think that we need to give a residency, legal residency to all undocumented that are currently working here in the United States. It's almost like we like to pretend that they're not here, but everybody who goes into a restaurant, if you go into the kitchen, who's working there? You know, you go into a building, who's doing the janitorial work there? All of this, lowest paid jobs that American citizens are not willing to do, you have all of these undocumented people that are doing it.
But anti-immigrant people would say, well, why should we reward someone who came here illegally? How do you answer that?
Well, I guess we might go back a couple of hundred years and say, what about all of your folks that came here illegally, right? I mean, we always like to say when I speak to Latino audiences, when they say go back where you came from, we like to say we are where we came from because we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. We're the indigenous people of this continent. The rest of you folks are the visitors because you came from across the ocean, right? We were part of this landmass to begin with. But it is complicated. It's not very easy. I think another thing, of course, is that when you have policies like NAFTA, where you have these free trade agreements that are actually causing thousands of people in the other side of the border order to become unemployed. When you have small farmers in Mexico or Central America that are trying to compete with American agribusiness, it's impossible for them to compete. So you have a small farmer in Mexico that had a small farm that maybe hired 40 people for his harvest. Now the farmer and his 40 people are all in the United States because they were wiped out. There was no way that this little corn farmer can compete with the corn farmers here from the Midwest of the United States of America. So it's our policies that have actually created a lot of that immigration. Our policies that we had in the 80s when we were, you know, bombing Nicaragua and El Salvador, that many of those refugees had to come over here to the United States. And then, of course, our policies in Guatemala, which again, you know, created so much instability in that country that has caused so many people from Guatemala to come here. So it's really our policies that somehow all of these countries are supposed to serve the United States, instead of us trying to see what we can do to build up decent governments, not to just support the dictatorships in these countries, you know, but to, you know, to actually build the economies of those countries so that people don't have to leave. Nobody wants to leave their home. You have people that live in a tropical paradise that come here to the United States, you know, to work like servants and to live in crowded neighborhoods and in high crime neighborhoods just to survive. And this isn't right. But we have to kind of look at ourselves and see what policies are we supporting? Are our tax dollars paying for that are causing this dislocation of millions of people?
You're listening to Dolores Huerta, a co-founder of the United Farm Workers. I'm Matt Rothschild, and the show is Progressive Radio. The AFL-CIO tried to stop NAFTA and wasn't powerful enough. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton actually helped get it through.
Right.
Right now, the AFL is in turmoil a little bit internally. And I wonder what your reaction to that was. Is change necessary in the Labor Federation? What kind of change is necessary?
Well, I think John Sweeney really tried to change the AFL-CIO when he came into office. He was talking about having communities, a union city, where you would have your whole, everybody in that city would be union supportive of trying to run union candidates for office. I think he had 2,000 candidates by the year 2000. That was one of his goals that he wanted to have. I think that there's been resistance that has been met because some people in the labor movement don't want to give up their positions or their salaries or their power, whatever you want to call it, and have not done the organizing that Sweeney hoped would happen. So I think there's some legitimacy to some of the criticisms that many of the labor leaders are saying that, you know, if we don't get out there and put all of our budgets to organizing, this labor movement is not going to survive. And this is would be a fatal blow to the democracy of the United States. You know, we've suffered a few blows already after 9/11 with the Patriot Act and all of our tax dollars going over to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But if we lose labor, we lose our middle class in our society because more and more you have where, you know, 40 years ago, a chief executive officer of a company made 40 times more than a worker. In today's world, a CEO makes over 400 times more than a worker. So we have this great economic imbalance in our society. And, of course, our tax laws that have been passed that make it easier for the rich not to have to pay their fair share of taxes, and the working class and the poor are paying more, then we have a great economic imbalance in our society. Labor is the equalizer because labor unions are able to negotiate for their workers and, you know, to redistribute the wealth so that some of it comes back to the people that are actually creating the wealth, which is what workers do.
Dolores Huerta, why do you think more people aren't joining unions? I mean, I saw a study somewhere that said millions of people wanted to join unions, but were afraid to do so or couldn't do so for one reason or another. Why do you think more people aren't in unions? Why have the numbers fallen so sharply?
Well, you have a very vigorous effort on the part of employers. They hire these anti-labor consultants. They pay them thousands of dollars a day, you know, how to fight a labor union. They do it through coercion and intimidation, letting workers know that they're not going to have a job if they vote for the union. And they don't do it overtly, but they do it in a way that workers understand. They go after the leaders that are trying to organize a particular facility, and they pressure them, and they get rid of them in one way or the other.
Even though that's illegal.
Yeah, even though it's illegal, and the unions can file charges, and it'll take like years to resolve a dispute like that before that worker can be put back to work and get his back wages. I mean, all the stuff that they do is illegal, but they have found a way to tie this up in the courts, and you know, so that they can. Some poor worker that's trying to organize is almost sure to get a pressured so that either has to leave or that he gets fired. He'll file his charge, and maybe 3 or 4 years later, it'll finally get settled. You know, so they become very expert, and they hire, like I said, all these anti-labor consultants that teach them how to fight labor unions, and the National Labor Relations Board does not really support the organizing of workers, especially now with the Republican administrations. It makes it harder and harder for labor to organize.
What do you make of the Bush administration?
I think it's a very dangerous administration. I think that it's definitely an administration that's for the very rich, and they're trying to reduce government. And when you talk about reducing government, you're talking about anarchy. When you're talking about reducing taxes, these are the taxes that pay for civilization. This is what pays for our police, our firemen, our streets, our libraries, our schools. And I was recently at the Cesar Chavez Library in Salinas, where in California, where there's an effort there now to close. The city council has voted to close the Steinbeck Library, John Steinbeck, you know, who wrote The Grapes of Wrath and these great stories. He's one of our great writers of our American society. The Cesar Chavez Library and another library. Three libraries in this small town of Salinas are being closed for lack of funding. And you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt during World War II, when we were fighting, you know, the big war against Hitler and Japan, that, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when they suggested to him that maybe they should take some of the money out of libraries and schools, said, we could not take $1 out of our educational system or $1 from libraries. This is the soul of America. And here we see under this administration that schools are being closed all over the country. The No Child Left Behind Act is leaving every child behind. Teachers are leaving. They cannot go through this testing. They don't have time to teach anymore. They have to go through all of this testing. Our Latino children are suffering incredibly because they're having trouble with the language in the first place. In California, the Republicans pushed a law through Proposition 227, which prohibits teachers from teaching their children in the Spanish language. You know, I was born in New Mexico. My grandparents were born in New Mexico, and they were bilingual. My mother and father were bilingual. I grew up as a bilingual child. You know, and it never, my education did not suffer. It was enhanced because I could speak two languages. And here we have this xenophobic, you know, kind of mentality that we should only learn to speak the English language, which is really idiotic when we're the world's most powerful nation, right? So education is suffering a bit, you know, and this is, I think, because of the policies of this administration. And then the whole thing about Social Security, you know, and they're not really trying to privatize, they're trying to eliminate Social Security. People should be very clear on that. And the person, one of the persons who's advising George Bush is a fellow named Pineda, and his friend, I think his name is Farad or something like that. These are the people that advised General Pinochet in Chile how to get rid of the retirement system in Chile. So, you know, Pinochet was a dictator, right? But we live in a democracy. So I think that in a democracy that we do have a responsibility to respond and to make our voices heard, that we do not like the policies of this administration.
Dolores Huerta, you've also been a pioneering feminist. I was wondering when and how you came to identify with the movement for women's liberation.
Well, my mother was, I guess, a feminist way ahead of her time. And so I kind of grew up in an equal opportunity household. You know, my brothers had to do housework just like I did as growing up. My mother never made me cater to my brothers like they do in a lot of traditional families, especially the Latino families where the women are supposed to be the servers. But I never had to serve my brothers. In fact, it was kind of just the opposite way around. So I kind of grew up with that strong feminist tradition. But then, you know, in the farm workers movement, as in the civil rights movement, you know, women were out there in the forefront. But yet you notice that when all of the dust settled and the positions were kind of ladled out, then all of a sudden the women started to disappear. In the farm workers movement, Cecil was very fair about that. You know, we started the union together. In fact, it was his wife, Helen, and myself. So Cecil was outnumbered from the beginning. But and he always put women in positions of authority in the organization. And when people would ask Cecil, why do you do that? You have so many women. He'd say, because they do the work. You know, they get the work done. But I think in a lot of places you see that the women sort of disappear. And either they get married and then they drop out or whatever. So we made a big effort in the Farm Workers Union to have a gender balance on our executive board. And that kind of changed after Cecil died. But they're coming back to it now. I was really happy to see at the last convention that they finally put more women on the board and the UFW.
Tell me a bit. You founded this Dolores Huerta Foundation. Mm-hmm. What does the foundation do?
The foundation, actually, what we're doing is that we are training community organizers. I am trying to preserve and pass on the organizing strategies and techniques and tactics that I learned from Fred Roth Sr. and, of course, working with Cesar also, because the type of organizing that we did in the United Farm Workers, when you do really deep grassroots organizing and you have to get people themselves to stand up and take the responsibility, they have to understand that nothing is going to change unless they do it. And I think this holds true for the rest of the people in our country. We can sit here and we can mourn and we can complain about what's happening. But unless we take the responsibility as taxpayers, as citizens, that this is our responsibility to change this and to do something about this, we cannot wait for somebody to come in and do it for us.
But I think a lot of people say, well, it's just too hard. You know, they've got too much power. The task is too daunting. Mm-hmm. I can't get it done.
Well, I think we have two good examples, just recent examples on this. Well, first of all, we have the example of the Farm Workers Union. Here you have Cesar Chavez, a man with an eighth grade education that by his dogged persistence in organizing was able to get farm workers to take on their own cause and make the changes that they needed, right? Then I think in our recent history, we have where George Bush came out and was going to do something about Social Security, and again, through organization and the organization of AARP and the elders in our society, we see him now that he's having to pull back on that because AARP came out there very strongly and said, no, you know, you're not going to get away with this, right? Just recently in California, our Terminator governor, Schwarzenegger, had announced that he was going to get signatures for an initiative to take away the pensions from public employees. So everywhere that Schwarzenegger went, he was picketed by teachers, by firefighters, by policemen, by public employees, by the nurses, everywhere that he went. Well, guess what? He just decided, maybe I shouldn't do that, right? So, I mean, we do know that politicians respond to pressure, right? And, of course, voting is one of the biggest pressures that we can lay on politicians.
Dolores Huerta, we only have about 30 seconds left. I saw something you said once that stuck in my mind and was, struggle gives you energy. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Well, when people think we can't do anything, if you actually get involved, then it does give you that kind of energy to keep on going because you see what changes what can be made when you take direct action. And I want to add something also. I'm on the board of the Feminist Majority. We have bought Ms. Magazine, and Ms. Magazine will be organizing Ms. Communities very, very soon. So we'll be reaching out to people also in forms of organization to get more women together so we can also save Roe versus Wade.
Well, let's leave on that note. Dolores Huerta, it's been a real pleasure, an honor, actually, having this half hour with you. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Okay. It's been my pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.